Fire away.
All right, we're exactly a week later, November 11th, 1985, or is it the 12th?
Today's the 12th.
And we're continuing this oral history project interview with Professor Frederick Cassidy. We left off last time with your departure from Michigan, I guess it was, just at the end of the 30s, and you had finished talking about your wife and...
Well, let me see. We left Ann Arbor. I got the job here, more or less by mail.
Mm-hmm.
I had never been to Madison. I knew almost nothing about Wisconsin. But I had had some work for the Linguistic Atlas of the United States and Canada, which was an ambitious name for a project which never existed except in name, but had real parts, such as the Linguistic Atlas of New England, the Linguistic Atlas of the Upper Midwest, and other parts like that, different sections of the big project, which have been accomplished.
Mm-hmm.
I had been working for the Linguistic Atlas of the Great Lakes and Ohio River Valley, which has since changed its name to Linguistic Atlas of the North Central States. That's it. LANCS. Lanks. And that covers the area including Ohio, Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, Wisconsin, Kentucky, and a piece of Canada north of Lake Erie, all of which are linguistically continuous, if not the same.
This was while you were at Michigan?
Well, I began it while it was in Michigan, but I did it on the way between Ann Arbor and Madison.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, I took some time off that summer and worked at it.
What did you do there?
Well, I left my family, which consisted then of my wife and one child, in Ann Arbor, and I went on in Ohio. We took my car and drove around to the areas where I was asked to make my fieldwork studies,
mm-hmm.
and did the thing that was usual in this part of the world. That is to say, we used a shorter questionnaire than the one used in New England, but it was an adequate questionnaire for the eastern Midwest, you might say, or as I said before, north central states. So I then went to these different communities, I think there were five of them, and did my fieldwork of collecting the material for the atlas. That was my cutting my teeth on linguistic atlas work, because I came to Wisconsin, to Madison, because I would have had this experience, and they wanted me to do the same thing for Wisconsin, only they gave me the second semester off of my being here. I taught the first semester. They gave me the second semester free to prepare for this linguistic atlas work in Wisconsin, and I mm-hmm. was to cover the entire state. Only one other study had been made, and that was not even complete. So I did 50 studies, 50 field records, in the state of Wisconsin between 1940 and 1941. I guess I finished it. I also had to put in a couple of summers at it besides the time I had to do it, but I went all over the state. It's a very fortunate thing for me, because coming into a absolutely new territory where I'd never been before and which I knew nothing about, within my first year and a half, I learned a very great deal about Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
Needless to say, I had to learn it if I was going to choose properly or wisely the communities to go to. I had to learn about the history of Wisconsin, the settlement, the different parts of the state, the different activities in the state, everything about Wisconsin that I could learn that would be appropriate to choosing the 25 communities that I was to go and study. In these 25 communities, I was to make two studies, one of one kind of person, another of another kind of person, all native speakers, of course. But we were trying to balance the ages, and we were also trying to that is, old, middle, and young, and we're also trying to balance the types of communities, thoroughly rural communities and thoroughly urban communities, and various things in between, small and large towns in between. So to be able to make a plan for the entire state, which was entirely up to me. In order to do that and do it properly, I had to learn something about the history of Wisconsin. And fortunately, some studies had been made, which I was able to use. And I remember especially the map of Guy Harold Smith, who had studied the ethnic picture of Wisconsin. The word ethnic wasn't being used much in those days, not at all the way it is now. But in any case, what he meant was foreign settlements of foreigners, non-English speakers in Wisconsin. But he took only not only non-English speakers, but also speakers of different kinds of English, such as Irish, Scotch, Welsh, and Cornish, and so on. So I got a very good picture of the settlement history of Wisconsin.
So there were people here who were interested in having someone do that work, and they came looking for you? Is that the way it happened?
Yes, Professor Miles Hanley was the person. He had been the associate editor of the Linguistic Atlas of New England. He knew a great deal about it. He was a brilliant phonetician and so on, and a brilliant teacher, despite rather ill health. But in any case, Miles Hanley was the person who really got me here for that purpose. Mm-hmm. And so they certainly turned, he got me the semester off. And so they turned me loose and said, all right, do it.
He was chairman of the department?
No, he wasn't chairman. He simply was the person doing the courses in language mm-hmm. and so on. But he was interested in this because he had been a very important person in the production of the New England Atlas. So, therefore, I spent my first 3 months, I think, working in the Historical Society Library, getting out all the books about the settlement and history of Wisconsin, and especially the ethnic picture, and deciding which communities, learning about the map, deciding which communities would be the best ones, or at least good ones, to go to, so as to get a balanced picture of the state. Mm-hmm. And having made that decision, I then set out in my car and went from community to community. And I did a certain amount of study before that, too.
By balance, you mean the ethnic balance?
Or well, not only variables? Ethnic balance, but balance in age, balance in degree of education, mm-hmm. balance in activity, but say people who were, well, let's say farmers and city people and all kinds of other types of people. I wanted to get a pretty good distribution of that. Mm-hmm. So that's what I did. I got out the county histories. We have a number of county histories made some time ago, but they usually have a biographical section. And in the biographical section, you find out who, back, let's say, in 1880, which were the families that had been important in founding that community and in keeping it going. So then when I went out there, I would go out and enter some community and find somebody and say, well, now nowadays, are there any of the so-and-so still around, Joan Smith, Becker, whatever? Are there any of them around? Oh, yes, there's so-and-so up, suppose it's a farming community, we'll say. Oh, yes, is up there near the mill, you'll find some of them still there. All right, well, then I would get the information on those people and see whether it looked as if they were going to be good informants. That's something that takes a little choosing, and you don't always choose the best, but you choose with some real principles in mind, and obviously the person must not be someone who is too old, let's say, is perhaps losing his grip a little bit, or somebody who is deaf. It's no good trying to have an interview, especially not a question and answer kind of interview with somebody who is pretty deaf. And other disabilities like that, a person who was a little bit weak or something. So I'd choose somebody who looked on paper or from hearsay to be a good person, and then I'd go up and meet the person and look him over or look her over for myself and see whether that looked like a good prospect. Mm-hmm. And if so, then I would ask the person if he and she would tell me about that community. And people naturally enough and wisely enough were not always certain that they wanted to say anything because they didn't know who I was and they couldn't trust my discretion and they wouldn't say anything very personal, obviously, certainly not at the beginning. And then people, naturally enough, also say, well, he says he wants to talk about the language. I think he's got beans up his nose, or something like that, you know. What is he really interested in? So,
well, when you were doing this work, was there, in terms of the way you developed your own methodology of field work, was there precedent for this kind of work, or were you sort of...
Oh, yes. The Linguistic Atlas of New England was the American precedent for it, had set the American precedent, and I was doing exactly what I had done in Ohio. Same sort of thing. So I went over the state and had my found my 25 communities. I found my 50 people in the 25 communities, two in each, and simply made my records. I have them still. They have been contributed to the overall project covering the states I mentioned, but and it is still in process. But that's 40 years ago.
So this had been going on for some time?
Well, while I was in Marietta, Ohio in 1939, that's when the Second World War broke out. I remember it very vividly. I was there wondering what was going to happen, and the newspaper was putting up bulletins on its front wall all the time. And then one fine day I went out there and they put up a bulletin saying that the war had been declared. And all kinds of things that we wanted to do, things of scholarly work, research, and other things like that, naturally enough, had to wait until the war was over, or if they kept on at all, they were keeping on at a very slow pace, a reduced activity. And that's a bad thing for everybody, I suppose. Certainly the war is. A war is a bad thing for everybody. But we kept on doing it. I had children, and so when the United States got involved, Pearl Harbor and so on, I was not called up for service because I had children and I was doing teaching that was considered to contribute to the war effort. So I just was in Madison the entire time. I also did not seek, as some of the professors did. They did seek military service, but I didn't.
What were you teaching?
I was teaching English, English language, English literature, English composition, and so on. Teaching the usual thing, though there were some courses specially made with military personnel. Courses which were, I would say, of somewhat questionable value. They were all done in a hurry. Everything was done in a terrible hurry, and that means that it's not necessarily done the right way. We did what we could with it, but it wasn't. I never felt I had accomplished a great deal. However, kept on with the Linguistic Atlas work then until I had collected it all for Wisconsin, and that was that. It had to wait until the other states had been covered before we could make the atlas. You can't make an atlas of just one piece. I think I finished Wisconsin before anybody else finished the other states. So they were done piecemeal by different field workers. I got my part ahead, but it just waited there. Mm-hmm. It's still waiting there to some extent, though the plan is going ahead now slowly. As soon as we get some further financing, I think maybe something may come of it. I hope so. This part of the United States is a very important one. It has those big states of Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Kentucky, plus that little piece of Canada that I mentioned. And those are big, important, populous states through which the settlement has gone. And you have lines of tradition and inheritance from the North and from the Midlands. So that, people who come through Kentucky probably started out in Virginia, whereas those who come through Michigan started out in New England. And so you have a very interesting thing to study, the way the language developed as they moved west, and all the new items that came into it from settlement of people who didn't speak English, the French and the Germans and the Poles and mm-hmm. the Norwegians and various others in Wisconsin, for example.
Did you have graduate students working on this with you?
Yes, from time to time there was a little money around for to help a graduate student to get on with his degree, and I latched on to what I could of that mm-hmm. and got assistance. I had several assistants, and I would say that most of them turned into professors.
Yeah. Was their work centered also on dialect studies?
Not necessarily, no. It was just simply that I needed pieces of research done in connection with it, or I needed to have the things that I collected put into order, filed so that they could be useful, indexed, and that kind of thing. This is before the days of computers, I might say. Mm-hmm. We'd probably try to do it with a computer now, at least if it is big enough. Though you can do it just as well with an ordinary file card and pen and ink if it's a small job. In fact, you can do it better if it's a small job. I mean, no use getting into the expense and all of that of computer unless it's a big job.
Yeah,
then
I want to ask you more about that. So this, you finished this task, and then was it on to Jamaican?
Well, I finished this task and kept on with my teaching and moved up the hierarchical scale. Mm-hmm. I had always had in mind that I would try to make a study of the language of Jamaica, because nobody had done it. At least the only thing that had been done on it was a good but very small study, and now very much old-fashioned, had no connection with the things I had been studying and teaching, that is, linguistic geography, lexicography, linguistics, and so on. None of that took part in the previous studies, so I could do something that was really quite new. Mm-hmm. It's always good to do something new, because you have the pleasures of pioneering, among other things, but also you make discoveries for the first time, which can be, if you make the wrong guess, or if you misinterpret things, of course you're wrong and you get reinterpreted by further scholars, but the pleasure of having been, and the satisfaction and the contribution of having been the first to take a field and really make some sense of it, is always there. That's what pleases scholars, anyway.
So when you started to devote time to the Jamaican topic, was it the same sort of methodology that you used in Wisconsin, or was it a different?
It was in part that.
Yeah. I'm interested in how this developed to the form it took in Dare. You know.
Yes, I can see. Well, I had done this linguistic atlas work. I had learned the techniques of planning and carrying out the fieldwork for a study of language distribution, language differences and language distribution, geographical distribution, also social distribution. Because as everybody knows nowadays, I think everybody always knew it, but more has been made of it recently, that there is always a correlation between a person's activities, a social position, origins, all kinds of things, and the kind of language that he or she speaks. We know that now. It's very prominent in our knowledge now, but people did not think of it in quite such terms in the past. Anyway, in Jamaica, where I had been born and brought up till the age of 11, I was myself bidialectal. I spoke a dialect of standard English at home with my parents and family, and I spoke with the servants and the people around, market people and all the other people, in fact. I spoke the Creole dialect of English. So I was in that position. I was a person who could handle the problem. People from the outside would have had a difficult time. In fact, I saw some of them come from the outside and have a difficult time because they hadn't learned the thing from childhood the way I had. And so they would pick it up the way you'd pick up a foreign language and never feel quite at home in it. I always felt at home in it. I knew it well. You feel almost as if it had been a part of you. Mm-hmm. And that's the way a language should be if you're going to pretend to really understand it deeply. and to interpret it accurately. So anyway, I had that knowledge of the Jamaican Creole and, of course, Jamaican English generally. I had linguistic training. I had linguistic geography training, dialect atlas training, all of those things, which nobody in Jamaica had, and lexicography, dictionary making. I had that too. So actually, if you come right down to it, there was nobody either in or out of Jamaica except myself who had the kind of training that was necessary to make the Dictionary of Jamaican English. So I had always planned to do something, and that's what I sought to do. From the linguistic atlas training and my dictionary work lexicography, and then linguistics in general, language study in general. So then I applied for a Fulbright scholarship and got it and went down there, spent a year, 1951 to 52. Again, as I had done in Wisconsin before doing the Atlas stuff, I spent 6 months at the Institute of Jamaica, which is one of the best libraries of Caribbean stuff anywhere in the world. Should be, but it is. It's a very fine library. And I simply went down there day after day after day and worked away at it. First made a list of all the... I went to the bibliography and I made a list of all the books that would probably have any language in them, words in them, pertaining to Jamaica. And then I went to the books then, after I had made my list of books that would probably be, that I ought to look at. I went to them and tested a few of them. I read them and marked all the words that seemed to be specially local to Jamaica. And then I went to the great big Oxford Dictionary and checked them out. And time after time, I found either that the word was not in the big Oxford Dictionary, or else that it was there, but I had an earlier example of it in Jamaica, or a later example of it. I sometimes found books that were listed in the Oxford Dictionary bibliography, saying that they quoted from those books, and then implying that they had had those books read for the project. And I would read the book and find a dozen words or more that were simply hadn't been picked up for the Oxford, which is not surprising. It is such a huge project. And also it had a lot of volunteer help, and the volunteers, many of them were untrained, and they therefore didn't always realize that the word they were reading was an appropriate word to put into the dictionary. So they skipped over or didn't see mm-hmm. a lot of things. You don't get that by birth, you get it simply by training. The only way to write a dictionary is to sit down and write a dictionary. You have to learn about it on the job, I think. Mm-hmm. I don't think you could do it in the abstract. So it's too minute and technical and so many, many things that you have to do. Well, anyway, so I went down to Jamaica then and spent 6 months there with my family along. And I was up on the university campus whenever that was appropriate. I didn't live on the campus, but I was away in town a great deal of the time at the Institute doing this reading, basic reading for the dictionary, and making a big file. Well, once I had done that and had satisfied myself, I had gone up through the 17th century and through the 18th century pretty much, reading every book and taking out all the information I could from them. They made a big file. But then I began to run out of time. I saw that if I was going to get out and do the necessary field work, I'd have to stop all this background reading. And in any case, the earlier things were the more important ones, and I had done those. So I then began to skip. And instead of doing the total list, I just did what looked like the most important books. And that way, I suppose I missed something, but better to miss it from the more recent end than to miss it from the earliest part, since I was doing a historical study. Well, so having made this big file, I then, from the file, worked out a series of questions on the basis of the Linguistic Atlas questionnaire, but altering it to suit Jamaica. And that took a great deal of alteration. Things are so different down there.
Yeah. How did you alter it?
By simply asking questions that pertained, well, suppose you were talking about plants or animals. Mm-hmm. The animals and plants in the Caribbean area are so different in many ways from the plants up north. This Linguistic Atlas questionnaire had been made for the New England area. Well, there's a lot of things in the mm-hmm. Caribbean that had to be accounted for and weren't there. But I simply made the thing over, and I was familiar with it, having used it in Ohio and Wisconsin, but I made it over to suit the Jamaican scene, and it, with alterations, it worked out very well. I got a very good list of questions to ask. Then I went into the country. I had a difficult time with the tape recorder. Nobody had taken a tape recorder all the way around Jamaica before. I was the first person to do it. The tape recorders in those days were
bulky.
Good, but bulky, yes. The tape recorder I had weighed about 35 pounds. Furthermore, I wanted to be able to play my tapes when I came back here, to be able to play them on tape recorders here without any trouble. And that meant that I had to have 60-cycle electricity. And there was very little 60-cycle electricity in Jamaica. They had 50 and 40. And one in a few places where there had been American influence, especially from the United Fruit Company, they did have 60-cycle, and there I didn't use a converter. But in the other places, I had to use a converter. I remember one one sugar estate on which I had to convert. They had both 60 and 40 in their electricity. These things were simply not unified or universalized at that time. Besides, one must remember that the farther away you are from the center of things, the longer it takes you to catch up, and the war had pulled them way down. There were all sorts of things that needed replacement and that they couldn't get. Certainly it always took much longer to get anything to the islands than to get them into the main places. Consequently, I had to have automobile batteries and an electric converter. And I had run the batteries through the converter to my tape recorder, and that's a lot of equipment which I had to take around uphill and down dale and wherever I went. And of course, the more equipment you have, the more mysterious it seems to people out in the country who barely acquainted with electric light and who are still using kerosene lanterns and such. And so to have all this equipment in my car made me a little bit suspicious, I suppose. At any rate, it made me somewhat magical. But people would, they had never seen or heard a tape recorder before, many of them. And certainly outside the city, they never had. And so what I found myself doing was not only recording their voices, but having to play it back so that they would believe that I hadn't done anything to their voices. Yeah. They'd hear themselves talk that way, and of course it was quite magical. Mm-hmm. But it cost me that much more battery juice.
Was there a regional flavor to that study even on the island?
Yes,
Did you have the same problem picking the right communities?
It wasn't really a problem. It was not really a problem. What I did was to choose my communities again to try to get a general balance. But there's not much urban outside of Kingston mm-hmm. in Jamaica. There are small towns. But Kingston is the only city worth the name. And so I did some work in Kingston, but mostly I wanted to get the outside language, because that's where the Creole speech is the most conservative. Up in the hills, out on the remoter places, the sea coasts and mountains are always the most conservative. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I went around the island. I had some help from various people, and I would, of course, go back every so often when it was convenient. I'd go back into Kingston and nearby, and where the university was. I'd go back there and see my family and see that all was going well. Mm-hmm. Then I'd light out into the field again. My wife was also teaching at the university, but our children were all old enough to go to school. So with some arranging and all that, we came through it all right.
So you brought it back here to edit them, right?
Well, then I brought something like 30 tapes, I think, 30 big 7-inch tapes back.
Do you still have the tapes?
Oh, yes. They're up above your head on the shelf. Mm. Yes, I have had them copied, and I have played them many times, and various people have been interested in them. They've been used in other research projects and so on. And one of these days, if I live long enough, I may put together the best parts with some commentary. It would be interesting to do. But anyway, that's the story. Mm-hmm. That was one full year in Jamaica, with the necessary research and at the library and research at the university and then the field work. And so I had enough stuff when I brought it back to Madison so that I could sit down for 2 or 3 years working through it, getting it all indexed and seeing what I had. And I did that. I got one whole semester free in Madison, in which time I was able to take my file of collected materials and check them through all the other important historical dictionaries. I checked them through the big Oxford, checked them through the supplement to the Oxford, and the big Webster Dictionary, and what else? The Dictionary of American English and the Dictionary of Americanisms. Checked them through all of those to see where I had something new, where I had something earlier or later than the materials there, dated earlier or dated later. And perhaps examples, every once in a while I'd run into something that was considered obsolete in the Oxford Dictionary. And it was presumably obsolete in England, mm-hmm. but it was still going strong in the outlying areas such as the Caribbean colonies. And I know that because not only in Jamaica, but you'd find it in Guyana and Trinidad, in Barbados, somewhere else.
Are the literary and the field work sources, do they complement each other? Do they overlap a lot in that
Yes,
study,
that or? Was a problem, and it's I think it's the only dictionary, the Dictionary of Jamaican English is the only one in which we have entries in capital letters and entries in lowercase letters, side by side, alphabetically as they sort out. The reason for that is that you have two kinds of language going together and intermingling. You have the standard English of standard English anywhere, the kind of English that gets printed, what you have from Britain and uses of it with local color in Jamaica and in Canada, in the United States, wherever you go, wherever English is, there is a basic, a sort of a core of general standard words. And wherever those occurred in Jamaica, with in print, with some Jamaican sense to them, or some meaning, some special turn of meaning, then I would put the word in capital letters. If, on the other hand, I found that word being used altogether or almost altogether in speech but never in writing, I'd put it in the lowercase letters. In other words, it would be a Creole word, mm-hmm. non-standard word, and Creole to some extent. So that is a dictionary. You see, in that area, you have a kind of a rainbow in which a whole series of different bands, frequency bands, melt into each other. The people who are talking extremely conservative, old-fashioned Creole up in the hills somewhere, remote places, old people, is one kind of thing. And then you've got down in the city, you've got others who have had education both in Jamaica and in Britain or in the United States or Canada, somewhere else, and who are up to date and everything else. They still have a Jamaican accent, perhaps, and they still have some usages that have come over as that are local usages, but just the same, they're at the other end of the rainbow, band of the rainbow. It is not. It's where you go from across the different color bands. So then you have the people in between, About two-thirds of your bands of the rainbow would be various forms of Creole, from very old-fashioned Creole to Creole that has been more and more decreolized, as we say. That is, it has been influenced in one way or another, pronunciation or syntax or word use, by standard English. So that, for example, you had a very old, old person, and he would say, Minohitat. Minohitat, which means I don't eat that. Mm-hmm. And those are the two extremes. Mi means I, no means don't, heat means eat. No, in fact, it's more conservative than that. Minonyamdat, that's an African word. Minonyamdat. And that is that. Mm-hmm. I don't eat that. Now, the very, very conservative person might say, Minonyamdat. But the other one who's speaking standard English, I don't eat that. Mm-hmm. So, and then there are all these different combinations in between, you see. You get a little farther up the scale, and the person does what I just did by accident there. He says, heat. And then when you get up beyond that, he'll drop the H and say eat in the standard form. And of course, dat continues up about two-thirds of the way up, and then it becomes that. And the person who has changed over to the standard pronunciation, that, you see. Mm-hmm. And no is Creole. You find it all over the world. It's in Africa, it's in Polynesia, it's everywhere you go. No means is a general negative. Not only in English, but in some other languages. Language bases. And so, me is the first person pronoun there, me. And then when they gradually get more and more adaptation toward standard English, the me is, you get I.
Mm-hmm. I suppose we should move on then to talking about dare. I want to get you to compare the work.
Let me just finish one more thing.
Okay.
To finish this Jamaican dictionary,
sure,
business.
Yeah.
I got another year Fulbright. They asked me to come down again, so Fulbright gave me another year, and I went down from 58 to 59, and more or less completed the work. I had had a couple of summers also going down there, so it took from the time I began it in 1951. Until the time the book was published, Jamaica Talk, in 1967, it was 16 years. That was off and on, teaching in Madison when, mm-hmm, I was here, but doing research on the side and so on. So it was a long, long business to get the book out. But then the dictionary and the book are based on the same base of material, so that what I had to do was to rework it and put in more things. The dictionary has a great deal more in it than the book does. But it's all the same material, and it's all made the same way.
Do you find just that this sort of dictionary work, this sort of study of popular usages, seems to, I mean, you can't help yourself put, you know, social science sort of explanations in, and it does the dictionary format sort of restrict that so that you have to?
Well, you mean interpretation or something of the kind?
Yeah, well,
social interpretation.
Right, why
well,
the language is
different?
Well,
you can read it out of a dictionary, such as the present one, a Dictionary of American Regional English, tells you that it's chiefly used by old people in a certain part of the country, and or else it's chiefly used by people with grade school education and so on. You can put that together and say, well, if you want to put it in those terms, you can say, well, only uneducated people say this. Mm-hmm. But that's not the way we put it.
Yeah.
We put it in a series of facts. This is what we have discovered. The people of such and such a degree of education do or don't use this expression.
Right.
You see? And then, of course, we do it with not only with age, but also there are certain racial concomitants there. It's not that black people and white people can't say the same thing. They can do it perfectly well, but they just don't happen to say the same thing on all occasions. And they have individual ways of saying these things.
Mm-hmm.
So that race and ethnicity, there are even some sexual differences where men say things one way and women say the other way, or even perhaps refuse to say at all. Or if you're trying to use a euphemism and not say the thing out vulgarly, a man would use one kind of euphemism and a woman would use another one. And there are all kinds of little things in which sex is the real basis of the difference. But geography, obviously, and whether your kind of life, the kind of occupation that you carry on, disposes you to one kind of usage or another, and undisposes you or indisposes you to something else. You talk to somebody. Well, on that radio program of last Saturday, the man who was questioning me happened to use the word breeches. Well, that's not what anybody who rides horses calls them. They call them breeches. And I stopped him on it. I said, you must be a city man. You don't know that you say breeches. You're saying it the way it's spelled. You're not saying it the way people say it. Well, that put him off a little bit, but he recovered himself quickly. Have to be quick on your feet on that kind of program. Well, anyway, you can tell these sorts of things, city words versus country words, and so on. The thing that's happened in many cases is, and certainly with literary people, is that they get a bit intolerant. If a person is not talking the kind of language that they would put into poetry or drama or their books, they somehow feel as though it's not as good language, which is a very biased way, it seems to me, to look at it. It may not be a very good language for a certain type of literature, no. If you're trying to do belletristic literature, that's one thing, fine, then you have a restricted vocabulary. But if you're trying to tame a Mustang, there's a different kind of vocabulary that belongs with that. And if you're trying to run a railroad train, there's another kind of vocabulary that goes with that. And it's not just the technical words. It's also the words of the kind of situations that you get into and that you have to handle linguistically. So people should not be so narrow in their language. They should be a great deal more, I don't say eclectic, but at least they should be a great deal more tolerant and recognize the fact that language is the biggest tool, the greatest tool that human beings have. Without it, we wouldn't have any other tools, or virtually none, nothing but maybe a stone to beat on another stone or something like that. But language is the first and foremost thing, and it shouldn't be narrowed. It should be accepted at all its levels and understood at all its levels. That's my feeling about it anyway.
Well, when did you first become concerned with the work of the American Dialectic Society?
I joined the American Dialect Society in 1939, when I had just come to Madison. There was a meeting the end of the year, as there usually is, of the Modern Language Association. And the Dialect Society had been meeting with the Modern Language Association ever since its founding in 1889. And so the meeting was down there. This time it happened to be in New Orleans, which was, I think, the only time they've ever met in New Orleans. But that was a long time ago, 39. And I went down to the meeting, and there was the Dialect Society meeting, and Professor Hanley, whom I mentioned before and who had got me up here to Madison, was the secretary of the society and an important member, and he sort of introduced me and said that I was doing the work in Wisconsin and so on. I got interested in the society. It was a small enough society so that I felt I could know the people and I wouldn't get lost in the rush. Modern Language Association is a tremendous society. It now has over 20,000 members, and it just, you can't know them all, you can't know the tiniest fraction of them. And it's just a sort of a mob scene wherever you go. I don't like that. I don't function well in those conditions. I like to meet people one in small groups or separately and so on, where you can really get to know them a bit. But at any rate, I went down to this meeting. I was a stranger, but Professor Hanley introduced me, and of course I was also very young and probably somewhat callow. But never mind. I got into it and then found out what the society had been doing and what its goals were and so on. And the more I saw it, the more I got interested in it, because here were all these things I'd been doing for the Linguistic Atlas, and finding out language differences, geographical differences, and some of the others. So from joining the Dialect Society, I kept on working in it, offering papers for publication, which were published, some of them, and became a member, regular mm-hmm. member of the society, and gradually became, well, I guess I was president for a couple of years, and so on. I did things for it. I did some of the work. I began to get the idea that since their dictionary, which had been planned practically from the foundation of the mm-hmm. society, was not getting anywhere, and there didn't seem to be anybody who was really going to do anything about it, so I said, why not me?
Mm-hmm. That was, I didn't have a look at the that article, but it's the...
In the early 60s.
Yeah, you published in the...
In the early 60s, I began to get impatient. I saw my own years running out, not as far out as they are now, but they were going by pretty fast. And I said, if I'm going to do anything about this, I better start doing it right away. So then I offered one paper for publication, and they published it, and it was the dictionary, How Soon?
Yeah.
You may have seen that, yeah. I don't know. Anyway, I told them, essentially, if we're going to have a dictionary at all, the only way we'll ever get it is to stop just drifting along and to set about making it, and you'll have to have a lot of money, and you'll have to have one person directing it, really taking charge and making it go. And of course, as soon as you say that kind of thing, you get elected.
Mm-hmm.
How to become a chairman, yeah. One easy lesson. Propose a committee. Anyway, that's the way it happened. They didn't elect me, they appointed me. But then I said, all right, let's get on with it.
And then there was the money problem from the beginning.
Friends went to work. They were people who had connections in government. And at that time, the Office of Education was just beginning to fund a few projects in the humanities, research projects. I think they were doing a big edition of Mark Twain, I think they were, something like that. And they decided, all right, we'll give you money enough to do your field work for 5 years,
mm-hmm.
which they did and which we did. We did. We had to push hard to do it, but we got it all done within 5 years.
So was there other problems in that field work and the forming the questionnaires and picking the communities?
Oh, we'd thought about that beforehand.
Compared to your early work, compared... other than just the sheer size of it, was there other...
Well, the sheer size of it, it got much bigger after we were into it. It mm-hmm. didn't have to be that big, but when we found the amount of stuff that we collected so interesting and valuable, it just grew in our hands, the dictionary did. But when I started it, I thought I could probably do it in 10 or 15 years. But it has stretched out because of the... a large amount of stuff that needed to be handled.
Mm-hmm.
And the Office of Education went out of that kind of activity. After 5 years, I couldn't have gone on unless, if in the meantime, the National Endowment on the Arts and the Humanities had not been founded. But it was. It was founded about 1967, if not 67, it's 68. But right in there, before we had finished out our 5 years, 1965 to 70, that organization was founded. And it was, of course, to support work in the humanities, so we shifted over to it. And the National Endowment for the Humanities has supported us to some extent, that is, sometimes more, sometimes less, but always steadily supporting us ever since. We've also had support from foundations mm-hmm. and so on. But without the National Endowment for the Humanities, we'd never have been able to do anything more. They're simply basic to us. And I think they're still They still think it's a good project.
Well, for them.
Well, that says something about their good judgment, yeah. I might say. Yes. So then we just simply, well, before that time, I had had it in mind, once I was made the editor of the dictionary, I had had in her undergraduate days, a student, now Professor Audrey Dukert of the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. She is in the English department there, professor. But she was simply a student finding her way in 1960, whenever it was, maybe 61. And she turned up in my History of the English Language course, and which was required of people who were going to be English teachers. And she took to the stuff very well, and I discovered that she had already had a good ear for language differences. She had German and Norwegian and Irish in her background, mm-hmm. and she was language conscious and also full of interest in it. So when I got a little money, I made her my graduate assistant to my project, and there she just simply went to town. I had a little radio program at that time for WHA. On Saturday mornings, I'd talk for half an hour, what I called Wisconsin Words, taking the stuff out of the linguistic atlas work that I had done. Well, Audrey was fine at that. She was very good, has a good voice that comes over the air well, and she's full of fun, and you know, the kind of person that you can listen to and enjoy. You don't have to be looking at a TV screen to enjoy it. She went over very well, and so she was interested in the work, so I kept her as long as the money held out as my assistant. And then she went east and got a job with the big Merriam-Webster Dictionary Company. And she stayed with them for some years, and I kept on telling her, you ought to take a doctorate. You shouldn't stop with an MA. You should take a doctorate. Finally, she got the means of doing so, the money, I mean, mm-hmm. and took time off and went to Radcliffe, which is now part of Harvard, as you know. She went to Radcliffe and got her doctorate. She was going to do a doctor's dissertation on Wisconsin language, but things changed so radically between the time she planned it and the time she was able to get back to it that she changed and did another one, Harvard doctorate. But anyway, she got her doctorate and started teaching and has stayed at the University of Massachusetts. So, but when it came time to do something about DARE, she was the first person to be interested in it, and we made a little study by mail of Wisconsin varieties, and it was on that we based our questionnaire. Mm. So we sent pads with questions on them to 50 people in the state, and we'd send them off, and people would fill these pads in, and then they'd send them back, and we had a lot of postal going and coming, mm-hmm. and we'd check them out and make them into a file. And on the basis of that, we published our questionnaire. And when we got ready to do DARE, the dictionary, there was that questionnaire there, which we had only to improve it a little bit, mm-hmm. in various ways and add on to it. But we had the basis of our DARE questionnaire. So that was a very good thing. You see, we have really been working at this off and on and in various, mm-hmm. ways for a long time.
Yeah, so you made your mistakes on the Wisconsin survey, and it was ready to go for...
Well, I don't know that we made mistakes on it exactly, but...
Well, I
know what you mean, yeah. Yes. No, the point was we tried out our method. Mm-hmm. But that was done by mail, and people would write down their responses. And that's not as good as to have an interview in which people answer directly in their own voice, in their own natural way. You see, you get a great deal more information that way. For example, on this written questionnaire business, I got a word back from a lady I forget where she was, but anyway, upstate somewhere. She wrote back and gave me, as an answer to one of my questions, a word that I thought was obsolete. And I, in any case, didn't think that she, from the kind of life that she led, would have known that word. So when I went back and interviewed all these people, I asked her, where did you get that word? And she said, I got it out of the dictionary. I said, well, but look, you know, you were supposed to give me the words you use, not something you dug out of a dictionary. She said, I know, but I didn't want to disappoint you. You see, this is the kind of thing that, that happens with a written questionnaire. Whereas if you have a spoken questionnaire, you get a spontaneous reply, and you also get the sound of the person's voice, so that you know what the pronunciation is. Sometimes it's an unexpected one, different from your own or whatever. It may be very regional. Whatever it is, you're getting a great deal more from a direct, personal interview than you are from a written response.
Those interviews, I imagine, have been used for other things now besides the...
The interviews?
The tapes, I mean?
The tapes. Oh, the tapes are something else. We made those for Dare. Mm-hmm. Those tapes were... They were not made at the time of questioning. They were a separate thing, an added thing. The tapes were supposed to be just... get the person, the informant, talking about something that he or she knew well. For example, a person has been a lumberman. Well, you get him telling you about the changes in lumbering since the time when he was a young man and the present time, or when he retired, or whatever. And he'll give you a whole history of lumbering from his point of view. Mm-hmm. Well, you see, you get all the right words. You get a person who knows what he's talking about. He's not inventing anything. And he is at his ease while he does it, so you can see what his natural language is. And when he uses a word perfectly naturally, you don't have to find it in a dictionary. He knows what it means. If you don't know, you ask him a question. I never heard that word before. What is it? Then he explains to you what a timber wheel is, for example, or something like that. We have 1,843 tapes made for the dictionary, and we have people talking about everything under the sun, but always things that they know something about. Mm-hmm. And so it's always interesting and genuine.